And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York City, 99.5 on the FM dial and streaming at WBAI.org, 9 p.m. Time for Revolutions Per Minute.
Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Revolutions Per Minute, live on WBAI 99.5. We are a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City's Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. My name is Desiree Joy Frias. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a CLC rep for the Bronx Upper Manhattan branch. Tonight on our show, we will be talking about my home of the South Bronx, where capitalist interests and government failures are continuing to cost our lives. In the middle of a brutal winter and yet another spike in COVID, tenants are once again mobilizing to defend against evictions and to build working class power with all of New York City's residents, including the 1 in 12 New Yorkers who live in public or Section 8 housing. Last week's tragic and preventable Twin Parks fire on 181st Street in the Bronx, and yesterday's Con Edison explosion on Fox Street less than 2 miles away, are just the latest examples of the ongoing violence of landlord neglect and failures by the federal and local government to provide adequate public housing and public infrastructure. Con Edison is being claimed responsible for yesterday's explosion that killed one, injured seven, and leveled an entire row home in the South Bronx. This exploitative monopoly spends millions in lobbying fees to fight green projects and remain the sole provider of power to over 12 million customers. Through my work in mutual aid organizing, I've seen firsthand the power of the Bronx community to come together and help the families affected by helping each other and not relying on charity or government, which is slow and ineffective in its response. To discuss this preventable tragedy and how socialists are organizing for tenant power, I'm joined live in the studio by my RPM comrade and fellow Bronx Upper Manhattan DSA member, Bernard Goiter, and an organizer from NYC DSA's Brooklyn Housing Working Group, Isaac. Tonight, you'll learn about NYC DSA's Right to Remain campaign to pass good cause eviction, transformative legislation that will protect millions of tenants just like us. Keeping with the Uptown theme, we'll also hear an update on the successful strike by the student workers of Columbia. We'll be taking your calls later in the show, so get your questions ready. But first, the headlines with Lee Zishi.
"200 incarcerated people at Rikers Jail began a hunger strike, now nearly a week old, to protest lack of medical care and other services. Video obtained by the New York Times this week showed incarcerated people on Rikers participating in a gang-led fight night and other violent conditions. Hundreds of New York City students at high schools across the city, including Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, and Stuyvesant, walked out of class to call for remote learning amidst the coronavirus surge caused by the Omicron variant. Mayor Adams cut the Police Oversight Civilian Complaint Review Board's budget by 3%, along with several other agencies. Council member Gail Brewer is likely to chair the council's Oversight and Investigations Committee against the wishes of Mayor Adams. Mayor Adams appointed his brother Bernard Adams deputy police commissioner, then demoted him to director of mayoral security after accusations of nepotism. Bernard Adams, a Virginia parking administrator who retired from the police force in 2006, will earn $210,000 a year. Mayor Adams's reported pick to head the Economic Development Corporation may have illegally performed lobbying work while he was the head of a real estate trade group. And last week, New York City DSA eco-socialist occupied 3rd Avenue outside of Governor Kathy Hochul's office and held a large rally demanding the governor include the Build Public Renewables Act in her budget. 10 people were arrested. The governor released her budget yesterday. In response, the New York City DSA eco-socialist released the following statement, quote, "The climate policies the governor announced in today's budget are not only too small to make the major progress science demands, they are almost entirely old policies negotiated by Governor Cuomo. This is not leadership. This climate plan will not reach our state's goal of 70% renewables by 2030, let alone 100% by 2040. The only way we will is with new substantive action like the Build Public Renewables Act," quote. And in election news, New York City enacted a law expanding the right to vote in local elections to over 800,000 non-citizen residents living and working legally in the city. Public advocate Jamani Williams will chair a new advisory group assisting the New York City Board of Elections to set up the new voter registration process. Governor Kathy Hochul, New York City public advocate Jamani Williams, and Representative Tom Suozzi participated in the first gubernatorial forum. I'm Lee Zishi with the headlines. Now back to you.
Thanks, Lee. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA's Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. You can get it directly to your inbox by subscribing at thethorn.nyc. So back to our live guest here in our studio. Hi, Isaac, and live socially distant, but live. Welcome back to the show. It has been a long time since you visited us, all the way back in summer 2019, and in fact, a world away. Last time you joined us, you discussed fascism and anti-fascism, and you're organizing around that work. So introduce yourself again to our listeners and tell us why you're a housing organizer with New York City DSA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry I can't be in the WBAI studio tonight. I always like looking at the George Carlin seven dirty words to remind me of the things I can't say tonight. I'm a socialist. I've been a socialist for a while. I can't really remember when I started. I think I read a comic book with like Marx in it or something, and that like was really convincing. Why I'm a housing organizer? Well, I like moved to New York, and you know, I was working in this kind of like social service nonprofit thing, and it was like I felt like I was like giving like shields to people. Like people were always coming in like housing issues. I was learning a lot about just like working class life in New York, but I felt like I wasn't giving people like swords. You know, I wasn't helping people fight. I wasn't empowering people. So I was like, I got to do something else. So now I work like a you know, kind of more fun job out in the woods. But I do work just, you know, working with tenants, talking with tenants, and, you know, just like talking with people and working together on how to like build a big, cool, democratic tenants movement.
And speaking of swords, can you give our listeners a little bit of a background on the housing bills that did pass in 2019? And the Right to Remain campaign today.
Yeah, so this is, I'll try to give as brief a background I can, but it's really a long fight. So it's like people have been fighting in New York for like, you know, like tents have been fighting in New York for 100 years for stuff. And every law we have on the books is like an artifact of like some kind of struggle, sometimes victories, sometimes losses. So then there's a bunch of losses actually in like from the 70s to like 2019, that included the 90s of severe weakening of rent stabilization laws in New York City that were like they're terrible. They just result in a ton of displacement. They like basically gave a monetary incentive for landlords to evict people. They could raise the rent a bunch just by evicting people. And so a ton of people like lost their homes. And I mean, it was just awful, awful, awful stuff. But because landlords basically control every branch of government in New York, we never could really fix that. And you know, the whole intelligentsia was saying like, oh, it's bad that people stay in New York for a while. They're actually speaking out against, go back to the New York Times and read what they're writing in the 90s. It's shocking. They're basically saying it's like bad in New York that people like stay in the same place for 30 years. They should move around more, basically. It's terrible. So in 2019, we kind of, this, you know, big movement, tenants, rah, rah, were very angry for a while, tons of anger, tons of organizing, and eventually kind of pushed Albany enough that they kind of re-strengthened rent laws essentially back to kind of where they were in the 90s. That included some significant tenant protections, mostly for rent stabilized housing. An important thing that wasn't passed was there was like 9 bills that were being proposed, 8 passed. The one that didn't was called good cause eviction. We like to call it the right to remain, but basically it gives almost every tenant in New York State as kind of statutory two really important rights. One, just the right to like reasonable rent increases, like kind of any rent increase below basically like 3%-ish. There's some like complicated math there. And then the right to stay in your apartment, essentially the right to a renewal lease. That's a right. I live in a rent stabilized unit in Brooklyn, and that's right. I have, it's right. A ton of people in New York have, and it's like a really important right that we have the right to renewal lease. That's a right to remain. And we think that's like a super important rent, right. Not just because it's, you know, good to be able to stay in your apartment, but also it really helps organize. And I think it's really going to be something that like, if tenants have this right, it's really going to, I'm never going to say it's going to make it easier to organize. Organizing is never easy. So it's never going to make anything easier. But when we do organize, it's going to make us stronger and make our organizing campaigns more effective, because it essentially is giving us a protection against landlord retaliation. Landlords love to just kick people out as soon as they organize. This is something that should be familiar to anyone who's ever lived in an apartment in New York. You never want to get in your landlord's bad side, because they'll blame you and then kick you out. So we're trying to stop that.
I agree. And people who have stable housing for whatever reason, they may not recognize the trauma and the financial costs, the emotional costs, the social costs, losing your friends, moving away from friends and family. For children, it directly leads to a drop in grades, a drop in school attendance, disruption of their education, disruption of their social circles. So moving and especially being evicted and being forced to move can be an extremely traumatic experience that you know, landlords can enact on people without recourse. And one of those deadlines that recently passed, not silently, because the Housing Working Group has been fighting all week, including an action on Friday in front of Governor Hochul's office, to fight to extend this eviction moratorium. But tell our listeners what deadline passed on Saturday and what an eviction moratorium is.
So what happened on Saturday was that the landlords won. I mean, that's just what happened. And I think we should be totally direct about it. Landlords won, tenants lost on Saturday. That's what happened. And so you go back to 2020, right? We're essential in 2020. And now in 2022, we're evictable. We're expendable in 2022. And so it's the story of the past 2 years, right? There's a ton of like working class struggle in 2020, tons of tenant organizing, people like across the city organizing tenant unions, a ton of tenant struggle. And we fought for something called cancel rent. What that was basically saying that like all rent owed during the pandemic, we're just going to kind of mass forgive that. And then if landlords do like have some financial need for something, then they can open up their books and prove to the state that they need some money, and then they'll get this money from the federal government. Landlords hate opening up their books, so they didn't want to do that. And actually, that includes some of the like nonprofits too, are kind of also landlords. So there's a lot of people who didn't want to open up their books. And actually, so we fought for like a year, and this eviction moratorium was part of that fight. We kept on extending it. And the only reason they extended this eviction moratorium was because they were, I'm talking about the bourgeoisie, right? The politicians, they were like totally scared. They were scared, like totally of our power. And then in March 2021, basically they kind of got together with some lawyers, some like kind of the nonprofits, and they wrote this thing that turned out to be ERAP that I think was basically designed to fail. This is really important. And then like, you know, this is the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. About a week or two ago, Hotel was kind of like, oops, we ran out of money. And her only kind of solution was to like ask more nicely or something. I mean, it's awful. Like it's this program that's designed to fail. It's like all these government programs is like totally humiliating, tons of paperwork. We had a better answer. And I think that, you know, speaks to something that socialists should all believe, right? Which is actually that like working class people actually know what's going on, right? And actually do have some good answers for these solutions. And they should be the ones who are like really in charge. They should be the ones who are like writing these laws. And, you know, tenants didn't write ERAP, you know, a tenant isn't the governor. A tenant is definitely not the mayor. You know how the tenants, you know how you know the mayor's not a tenant? Because he blames tenants. Landlords always blame tenants. So the mayor blames tenants for, you know, dying in a fire. Landlords will blame tenants for, you know, wanting to live in a house that has like, you know, hot water in it, right? Landlords will blame tenants. And actually politicians now are blaming tenants too. And that's really the story of like why the eviction moratorium failed or why the eviction moratorium was removed was basically politicians were like, there's all these problem tenants, these tenants who are saying these ridiculous things like, you know, we should live in our home or we shouldn't get evicted, right? I mean, and that, you know, really convinced a lot of politicians and right politicians, right? I mean, they're part of the state. What does the state serve? Does it serve the working class? Does the state serve the toilers of the earth? No, the state serves the landlords, the state serves the bourgeoisie. So of course, you know, eventually like this messaging really gets through. And like, I mean, you see, like, look at the news, you see in the New York Times, you see in all these major publications, they have these stories. The New York Post has them all the time of these poor landlords who are struggling and the, you know, the evil tenant. I mean, that's propaganda, right? So this is par for the course, right? It's the great return, status quo anti-Biden, right? We're going back to 2020. And this time it's going to be even worse, right? So they're really trying to turn back the clock. They're trying to like make us forget about all the struggle, trying to make us forget about like that we were like marching on the street and we burned down police precincts in 2020. And you know what? I don't want that to happen. So tenants have got to take responsibility. And if the landlords and their like kind of bosses and the politicians aren't going to take responsibility for this problem, tenants are, we're going to stand up and fight. We're going to stay and fight in our homes. And I want everyone who's listening right now to remember to stay and fight, which really means if your landlord is trying to evict you, you have to stay and fight that. Don't leave. Don't self-evict. Stay and fight because we're going to take responsibility.
Form a tenant union. Absolutely. With your neighbors. You can get help from organizations, nonprofits like CASA, Community Action for Safe Apartments. You can get help from Met Council on Housing. You can get help from the New York City DSA Housing Working Group.
Yes, I'm happy to help.
So, yeah, do not leave. Once you pack your bags and leave, your legal protections, for the most part, end there. And, you know, this winter has been brutal for tenants between the end of this eviction moratorium, freezing temperatures, a COVID spike, and, of course, the tragedy of the fires in the Bronx. And it's no coincidence that all of these things are happening right now and that they would choose now for the eviction moratorium to end when people are most vulnerable, when people are most exhausted, most overwhelmed, and when they feel that you have the least amount of power as tenants to organize and fight back. So we're going to hear more about the Right to Remain campaign and how the New York City DSA is doing the housing work to get that passed. But first, I'm going to take a quick station break. And we're going to be taking your calls. So get ready with those phones to call into our station. But for now, you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcasting app. Today, we're talking about socialists fighting back to protect tenants and end evictions and other landlord abuses. We are fundraising for the rent on our transmitter tower at 4 Times Square this month. So if you're inspired by the message of this show, please consider donating so that that message can be heard throughout 2022 and beyond. To give to the station, call 212-209-2950. Again, call 212-209-2950 or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Before we get back to Isaac and the struggle for housing rights here in New York City, let's check in with another fight. Regular listeners of Revolutions Per Minute have visited many picket lines with us, especially in the current Striketober, Strike November, all the way up to Strike January, and the recent strike uptown at Columbia University. Earlier this month, that strike ended in a victory for the student workers of Columbia University. For an update, let's go to Chris Carr.
So, hi, Kit. Say hi to the people.
Hey, everyone. I'm Kit Hermanson.
It's great to have you on and to have a fellow member from the student workers of Columbia. Full disclosure to our listeners that I am also a member of SWC. So the last time we covered the strike on RPM was way back in mid-November. But as we both know, a lot has happened since then. But before we get into it, just for like a quick reminder for our viewers, why did the student workers of Columbia decide to go on strike past November? And over this series of weeks that the strike lasted, what was your role contributing to the strike effort?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a religion PhD. I study 19th century utopian communes in the United States. And
oh, really? That's cool.
So. Oh, yeah, it's pretty dope. I have a pretty dope research topic, not to brag. But yeah, and so my main kind of work that I do with the university is instructional work. So teaching, I've been a TA for, I think I did 6 semesters of TA work. This last semester that we were on strike would have been my last one. And yeah, so that's a lot of like instructional work. It's a lot of grading and holding discussion sections with students to make sure they understand content and things like that. What I'm paid for this in the past was several thousands, probably around like $8,000 below the suggested living, like standard living wage for New York City. Despite the fact that, you know, I'm a full-time student and on top of that was doing 5 to 10 to 20 really hours of work a week, depending on where in the semester and the needs of the professor. Yeah, and that on top of COVID and inflation of the past year for a lot of students, some of whom were paid even my salary last semester before the tentative agreement, before the contract, would have been around $31K a year. And that's supposed to include like instructional and like your fellowship for your PhD work. Some people's were like in school social work were as low as 29,000. And for a lot of people with COVID and inflation and everything, it became like an untenable situation. And on top of that, people have children and there was like very bad childcare subsidies. I've needed my wisdom teeth out for 5 years and haven't had dental insurance and couldn't afford to pay for dental insurance with my wages. Yeah. And so I think really this year, we've been trying to unionize since like, well, really since the 80s, but like more recently since like 2014. And I think this past year, you know, with the pandemic and everything and kind of like the cultural landscape around attitudes towards work and what your employer should be able to expect from you have really changed and gave us the kind of like strength and momentum to hold a really strong strike and finally get to a TA, a tentative agreement. That's a good one as compared to the one last spring that was terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that we have like a short time together, but it's really hard to really convey like how big this was for a lot of us who are sort of in this, how much of a big deal it was that we were able to finally reach a TA agreement like with the right. university. Although of course the TA has yet to go to a vote where all of our members will ultimately decide if we want this contract or not. But getting back to this TA, what were some of the major wins and also some of the disappointments that we got in this agreement?
Yeah, I mean, so a major win is the one thing that has been at the core of our contract is because we all know how terrible Columbia is at handling discrimination and harassment, and especially like cases of like sexual harassment or sexual assault. They're like notorious. You can just Google anything and Columbia comes up with like 50 different lawsuits that are happening. And graduate students and student workers in particular are in a really vulnerable position in these situations, right? We have this kind of like weird powered structure where we don't really have authority and we don't really not have authority that's made people very vulnerable in their workplace. And that one of the biggest wins is we got neutral arbitration, third party arbitration for discrimination and harassment cases, which will let essentially make it so that Columbia is not the only person investigating itself. And students and workers who are harassed or discriminated against at Columbia will be able to have their cases reviewed and decided upon, like, freshly by people outside of Columbia who don't carry the university's best interests above that of the survivors. So that's probably the biggest thing, because we were, like, said it, we were told over and over again for years that that would never happen.
Yeah,
and with a 10-week strike, apparently it can happen. The other big things are dental care coverage. So we get 75% of our premiums, a huge boost to child care subsidies, I think like a $4,000 boost to the child care subsidies, transition funding for PhD students who are like in a bad relationship with their advisor to be able to try and find a new advisor without being broke during that in-between time. Yeah, a health fund, which, like, for out-of-pocket expenses and co-pays that we can't afford to pay, we can take out of this collective health fund for the union. A bunch of stuff. There's definitely more I'm forgetting. I mean, probably the biggest disappointment was, I mean, compensation. We're still, despite the fact that, like, some people in our unit, like social work people that I said before, are getting, like, 35% raises, we're still pretty far below the suggested, like, MIT calculator suggested, like, living wage for New York City.
I think another big win for the contract was full recognition.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, full recognition. Yeah, that's the big one. So I think, like, to me, it was never a question of, like, we're going to do a contract without it. But yeah, we got full recognition of all the workers. And so student workers, undergraduates, master's students, PhD students, whether they're hourly or salaried or anything, are all collected within our union and therefore, like, get these, like, compensation benefits, neutral arbitration for everyone is huge, dental care, things like that. Everyone is eligible based on how often they work for some different ones like dental care. But yeah, full recognition within the unit means that we all have, like, kind of the power to band together under a much larger banner to be able to fight for things in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess as we try to wrap up here, if listeners are interested in wanting to learn more or supporting grad students who were on strike for over 10 weeks and still to this point have not received back pay, what are some things that they can look into if they're interested in helping out?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest thing, I sit on the Hardship Fund Committee, which handles the Hardship Fund, which we raised over $300,000 to give to striking workers who are in financial distress. We've given out a lot of that, but now the problem is, like, we're obviously not getting back pay for being on strike. And so for a lot of people, that means that they owe debt to Columbia, because Columbia is often their landlord as well as their school, and aren't able to re-register for their programs. So right now we're trying to raise more money in order to, like, let people continue with their PhD programs or their student work, pay for housing, food, childcare, things like that. If you're interested in donating, you can go to just Google Open Collective Hardship Fund Columbia Student Workers, and that will take you to our donation page, and you can donate there. You can also, as of the 20th of January, we have a merch shop with a lot of, like, handmade and union designed and produced, like, t-shirts, bandanas, patches, stickers, things like that, all of which are, like, pro-union kind of things that you can adorn yourself with. And all of the proceeds from that shop are going to go straight to the Hardship Fund as well.
Yeah, excellent. So thank you, Kit, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You just heard Kit Hermanson in conversation with Chris Carr on the recent victory for organized student workers at Columbia University. I'm Bernard Goyder, a journalist and a member of the Bronx and Upper Manhattan DSA. Desiree, as you said in the intro, there have been two serious fires in the Bronx this month, including one on January 9th that killed 19 tenants and injured many others. And just this week, another explosion on Fox Street. Tell me about what's going on in your neighborhood at the moment. Tell me about what you saw this week.
Yeah, so I live in the South Bronx. I was born and raised here. And on Sunday, January 9th, the Twin Parks fire at 333 East 181st Street killed 19 people and left 64 injured. The Department of Health and Buildings says that the building is safe to live in, but residents are reporting smells of smoke and chemical smells, probably from the burnt materials of the building. And a lot of them feel too traumatized or that it's physically unsafe for them to return. The 20-floor public housing building had 20 open HPD violations, including for a faulty boiler and for not having heat. Daniel Nigro, who's the commissioner of the New York City Fire Department, blamed a malfunctioning electric space heater and the apartment door being left open while the families fled their units as the cause of the fire and the cause of the fire spread so much. And this is a narrative that's been picked up by politicians and by the media, basically blaming the family that experienced the most loss which is the Drame family, for causing the fire. So that was last Sunday, January 9th. And then yesterday, less than 15 blocks away at 869 Fox Street, there was a Con Edison gas explosion at 11 o'clock in the morning that killed one and injured seven. It leveled a row house and left eight more buildings structurally unsound. So that's what our community has been reeling from in the past 7 days.
And there's, for many of our listeners of an older generation may remember that the period of the Bronx burning and the fact that there was a time when landlords would set their buildings ablaze to collect the insurance money. What do you think the significance of this week's events has in terms of your community and community solidarity and how the community responds to these attacks by landlords on, and just in, and I say the word attack very deliberately, in terms of declining to invest in the safety of the buildings, cutting corners with safety, not listening to tenant complaints?
Exactly. So a lot of people have a perception of negative about the Bronx and the people that live there and the conditions that we live in. A lot of that is due to media perception and this concept of the Bronx is burning, which was stated at a Yankee game in 1977 by a sportscaster because there was a building aflame that could be seen from the game. And it turns out that landlord, after a trial, was found to have committed fraud and had intentionally set the building aflame to collect insurance money. They would often do this without notifying the tenants, obviously, and it cost a lot of lives and displaced hundreds of families throughout the 70s, 80s. And I believe that this is still occurring today. It's no coincidence that the fire and the explosion in the last week happened in the South Bronx, the congressional district with the lowest AMI in the United States, and a community that has, like you said, seen redlining, gentrification, intentional displacement, and a lack of investment by landlords. And essentially, you know, constructive eviction, which is when a landlord turns off your heat, turns off your gas, makes it so you don't have running water, and forces you, like we were talking with Isaac earlier, to say, all right, I can't take it anymore. I'm too exhausted. I'm cold. And I need to leave. And once you leave, then
you lose your rights.
Yep, they can flip the apartment, they can jack up the rent, and they can make more money because that is their only goal. So that is what we've been living with here in the Bronx. And, you know, this is taxpayer money that they rebuild the buildings with, federal grants. And it's just a cycle that is exhausting for me and my neighbors.
What do you think we as socialists and listeners who are active in their communities, active in your blocks, active in your block association, can do to support our neighbors in the Bronx and to help kind of build solidarity within the New York community?
Yeah, so anyone who's been around a natural disaster knows that FEMA is inadequate, that The Red Cross, as much great work as they do, are often not connected to the community and do not do work in a way that's culturally sensitive to the community where they live. And this charity model has not served our community's needs. So I really encourage comrades to consider the mutual aid model. I've been on the ground since Sunday with the Bronx Upper Manhattan branch and the South Bronx Mutual Aid at the Gambian Youth Organization, which is an office two blocks away, helping our neighbors affected by the fire. So a lot of people have come to help, lent their hands, lent their time, and also donated clothing, food, things that we have distributed directly to our neighbors. And you can join us as well to volunteer to sort, organize, and transport donations to storage while victims secure permanent housing. So if you want to get connected, you can see you can join us on Twitter at UptownBXDSA.
And just quickly before we move on to the next segment, do you have anything? If Eric Adams is listening, I don't think he does listen. What would you say to him about the fact that he chose to go out there in public and blame the victims for this fire?
Yeah, so it's pretty easy to dunk on Eric Adams at this point. I think that if he doesn't rack up enough ethical violations, that the city council ends up having to deal with him before the end of his term. But that's his own business. I would let you know and let the listeners know that as someone who has been on the ground, I saw him come to the Janazah funeral prayer and leave 15 minutes later after he took his picture. He didn't bring hand warmers, which we asked the city for multiple times because it was 9 degrees out and there was 2,000 people at the funeral. He didn't bring any water, hot drinks. All of that was provided by mutual aid organizations. And it just shows that, we can't sit around and wait for the city to take care of us because we take care of each other in community way better than they ever could. And so I'm not surprised that Rick Graber is a member of the transition team and that Adams is suspiciously taking a pro-landlord stance and blaming the tenants for the cause of the fire. But we know the truth that the families had space heaters on because they were freezing to death. It was 9 degrees the day of the fire, and people are dying and freezing to death in their apartments. And this is not, it's the standard of living is extremely low for these tenants, and they have a right. They have a right to stay. They have a right to heat, hot water. They have a right to a roof over their heads. These are fundamental human rights that we shouldn't have to keep fighting for and keep relitigating every single year.
We'll be opening our phone lines here in the studio in just a minute. But first, we're fundraising for the rent on WBAI's tower transmitter, an important resource that will enable WBAI to keep broadcasting local programming throughout 2022 and beyond. If you like what you're hearing right now and want us to keep doing this, please give to the station. You can call 212-209-2950 or visit towerfund.wbai.org.
It's really important that we all pitch in. Some of us don't have much or anything to give financially, and that's okay. But for those who do have the funds to share, do your part. Donating to WBAI is a great way to put those dollars to work in a high impact way and support locally produced programs. So call 212-209-2950 or visit towerfund.wbai.org.
Listener participation is a really important part of what we do here at WBAI. And we would really encourage listeners in the Bronx who have personal experiences of that community that they'd like to share to give us a call. You can call us. And Amy, would you like to give the phone number for listener call-ins?
Would I like to give the phone number for listener call-ins? Absolutely, I would, Bernard. Yeah.
Excellent, because I don't have it in front of me.
212-209-2877. Please, we've got a great crew here in the studio, and we really want to hear your thoughts and comments about the Bronx fire and questions for our housing organizer, Isaac, who's live here in the studio. Please give us a call, 212-209-2877.
So while you're preparing your call, I want to give a thanks to my team here at Revolutions Per Minute. It has been so exhausting and really upsetting to hear the media continue to blame the family for the deaths, and saying, oh, they had a space heater. Oh, they didn't close the door. When you're fleeing for your life, you're not going to close the door. And if the landlord had installed fire doors on a 20-story building, then the fire would have been more contained and more lives would have been saved. So in my opinion, the blood is on the landlord's hands, and he should not be able to sleep at night knowing that if he had given them heat, they would not have had a space heater. If he had upgraded the building, there would have been fire safety measures in place, and we would have not injured people, cost us lives, and led to all of this devastation.
Thank you, Desiree. We're also here with our fellow organizer, Isaac. But we'd love to hear your thoughts. Max, have we got any callers yet?
We have one.
All right, caller, you're live on the air with WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hi, it's Russell. I used to live in a 20-story subsidized project in the Bronx when I grew up. And the kind of doors that were used in 1972, you understand that the closing mechanism was in the hinge. And you take a pin out of the hinge, and the door no longer closes. And one of the problems in that building I was reading is that smoke alarms were going off every day, four or five times a day, because people were smoking in the hallways. So smoke alarms were working. The doors were self-closing doors, but they were tampered with, I assume, by the tenants, because it was a building that was filled with relatives and people all from one place in the Gambia. So they were probably going in and out.
Okay, so first of all, that's fundamentally untrue. The building was actually made up of 20 floors of people from all over the world, mostly migrant neighbors. There was a big population from the Gambia, but that doesn't correlate with the accusations that you're making, that the tenants destroyed the building. And the issue, this actually reflects back, Isaac, to what you were talking about. You were talking about anti-tenant sentiments. Right. And where do you think that this drive, Isaac, comes from?
Well, are you going to let me continue
blame
talking?
Tenants.
Just cut me off. Are you cutting me off? Because I want to ask a question.
I am.
I ask a question? Okay, because...
What this really reminded me of was something that happened like 41 years ago in London, the New Cross Massacre. I mean, it was another residential fire, 13 dead. And the tagline after that was 13 dead and nothing said, because, you know, the media wouldn't kind of apologize. Usually in Britain, when like something tragic happens, the Queen will send a letter to the parents. That never happened. And they just blamed these tenants because they're like working class immigrant tenants from the West Indies. And they blamed them for this fire. And there is never any justice, even though a lot of people who are there have very good reason to believe that like it was a kind of like racist white supremacist who threw a firebomb at this building. And, you know, back then they didn't believe them because they don't believe the working class, because they don't believe immigrants. They definitely didn't at this time in England were incredibly racist and certainly wouldn't believe the trauma of like, you know, 13 families over like what some, you know, cop would say. And I think it's, you know, similar now. They believe some people and don't believe others, and they, you know, want to fit a narrative into this. And it's just really tragic. I can't really, I can't say more than that.
I lived in London for 9 years, and we had the Grenfell fire in 2017 in public housing. Those were people who were in what's the equivalent of a NYCHA project here. But the local government refused to invest in it and refused to listen to the tenants' complaints. And again, it's the same thing. It was mostly an immigrant community. And these people were ignored, and they lived a mile from some of the richest, most expensive property in the world. Often billionaires' apartments lying empty, while these people were crammed into a 24-story building that burnt. And I saw it. It's one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. And sadly, capitalist countries treat the poor, the workers, the very people that have that have saved us in this pandemic, the essential workers, they're those immigrants that live in those buildings. I think we've got another call.
Yeah, so our phone number is 212-209-2877. Let's go to the next call that's on the line.
Hello? I'm on the line?
Yes, thank you're you. Alive.
You're live. I heard on the news that this place was had Section 8 vouchers in it. And isn't Section 8 supposed to come in and inspect the building every quarter or something like that before the vouchers are finalized? And also, I was wondering if the landlord can be held criminally liable because the doors are supposed to be so that they can close properly. And if they can't, can he? I know there's going to be a lawsuit, but shouldn't the landlord be criminally liable? You know, like
yeah, absolutely. Those are two great points. I can't speak to the kind of legal nature of either of those questions, but I think they're great questions to be asking. And those are questions I would say we should be asking instead of the questions that have been being asked right now. I think we should be asking questions like, why wasn't the HPD inspector here? Why wasn't HUD inspecting this?
And there were 20 open violations. So yeah. They did inspect it. They found it to be in violation. But did they force the landlord to make the changes that would have saved these people's lives? No.
Yeah. The fact is, like, enforcement is under budgeted, right? There's never enough money for enforcement. And anyone who's ever called 311 knows you have to call like 20 times before inspector comes, and then best case, it's like a small fine. And this is a very rich landlord, right? A lot of these landlords would rather pay the fine than fix things. It's actually would be cheaper for them to pay the fine than fix things. So there's That's a lot right. of issues with enforcement.
And another call. You're live with WBAI. Yes. Hello, you're live on 99.5 WBAI.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, I can hear you.
Can you hear
what
me?
Is your question?
Yep.
Hello, how you doing? I just wanted to say thank you for your program. I was a resident of public housing when I was younger and partially as of my adult life. And New York is famous for rent gouging landlords and tenant abuse. These people had space heaters on because they were freezing. They weren't getting sufficient amount of heat. And for Eric Adams to have this person on his transition team, just all I can say is I didn't vote for him, and I hope his term is short, and I hope we can get someone in there who really who cares about the people of New York, because I believe
absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't vote for him either. I don't think anyone else here did. Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, something that was pointed out by both Isaac and Bernard is that there is no coincidence that this fire, that the Grenfell fire in London, that these fires across the world happen in low-income, migrant, working-class communities. This fire did not happen on 86th Street and Lexington Avenue at a millionaire's house on Park. No, this happened in the South Bronx, and a week later, the gas explosion happened in the South Bronx, and this is a pattern. It's not caused by the tenants. The pattern is caused by the landlords, the city, the HPD that is not enforcing, either for lack of funding or for lack of will. But either way, that is why this is happening. If we can take our last caller, I think we have one more question.
It's greed. It's greed. It's not even
absolutely. It's greed. Greed. Yeah.
Plain and simple. Yep. It's greed. And a disregard for human life. And these people
absolutely.
They need to be taken out and shot. That's my opinion.
I don't think we all believe that violence will be the answer to violence, but I respect your feelings of rage because they're so warranted at this point.
That's what people are
our
feeling.
Last call, Max.
She should be there. Hello.
You're live on WBAI 99.5.
I guess she couldn't wait.
No.
Okay, no problem. Isaac, is there anything else you want to share about the Right to Remain campaign and why it's a New York City DSA priority campaign?
Yes, I want to share some links right now that all the listeners who want to join our campaign go to this website, bit.ly/joinbkhousing. That's bit.ly/joinbkhousing. You can also see our kind of like website at socialists.nyc/housing. So this is a big campaign. It's a democratic, we run our institute, our working group, like a, you know, democratic organization. Everyone can join, everyone can participate. And we all really big open conversations about like what the strategy of this campaign should be, what should work, what shouldn't work, right? Because our campaigns are actually stronger when we run them like that. So I really want to encourage everyone who is like fired up by what's going on right now to, talk to your neighbors to organize a tenant union if you can. That's a big ask. But, you know, if you're even interested in anything like that, please reach out to us and we can work with you even on like small things, just like trying to figure out how to get your heat fixed. We can work with you on that. And that's really the like beating heart of our campaign is like tenant organizing and like tenant power. I also want to give one shout out if I can to Cosmonaut Magazine and Cosmopod podcast. I'll just always like to shout them out when I'm on the radio. I think they're great. Kind of broadcasting thing, and it's another broadcasting project I've been part of.
Yeah, we're so thankful to have you on, Isaac, to talk about housing rights in New York City. And I think it's important for people to remember that, you know, landlords, yes, they can be very scary because they hold so much power over your life. Your home, for me, there's nothing more sacred than my home, than my space where I get to rest every night and get up and fight in the morning. But even if your landlord has all the money in the world and is funneling it into Albany to lobby, that doesn't matter because there's more of us than there are of them. And by learning skills from the New York City DSA Housing Working Group, by workshopping your own problems with them, or by hearing about other people's tenant struggles, you're going to learn the skills and get the tools that you need to win against your landlord. And, you know, as one tenant wins, I really do believe it's a domino effect. And we're going to continue to have more and more victories into the future. So, Isaac, how can people talk to their elected officials about passing this bill?
Yeah, that's a great question. You should absolutely reach out to us. We have a kind of tool. It's like an auto dialer. And if you give me 1 or 2 minutes, I'll find the phone number and tell everyone how to use that tool. But basically, it's this tool that allows us to kind of just call your electeds and tell them to support this bill. The right to say right to remain, say good cause eviction. And I would just say, like, talk to the electeds about your story as a tenant. Talk to them about like your truth, right? Your story. Electeds are listening to a lot of landlords right now, and they're listening to a lot of, I'll say, crap, right? A lot of bull crap by landlords. And a lot of these like electeds really need to hear the voices of tenants. And I think one thing I want to add too is I think changes like right to remain are really, really important. They happen through Albany. I think these are all the rights you can win just from your landlord. They're rights you can win through tenant organizing. And I really want to lift that up as like another way that like change happens, another way to win improvements in your building. And I think like both of those need to be happening.
Yeah, I'd be definitely get us that phone number. I mean, how could Eric Adams possibly know what it's like to be a tenant in New York City when he doesn't even live here? So these, you know, there is nothing more powerful than sharing your story. No matter what you're going through or things you've gone through in the past, you know that your neighbors in NYCHA, your neighbors using Section 8 vouchers, are still experiencing a lot of the same hardships that they have been for the last 50 years, because things have gotten better in some ways, but in a lot of ways, the housing conditions, especially in public housing, remain the same, and so do the threats to our very lives for those of us who live there and live in apartments across New York City. So thank you so much, Isaac, for coming on and sharing your experience. Thank you, Bernard, for talking with me about the Bronx. And Isaac, we'll be sure to drop that phone number in the show notes. But thank you, listeners, for joining us today. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcasting app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. I'm Desiree Joy Frias. Stay tuned next week for an update from the struggle for free abortion on demand and much more. Stay strong, take care of each other, and solidarity forever.